Worried about your future in tech? Master new skills, accelerate your team's impact, and redefine what's possible with Pluralsight. We're more than just another online learning platform. We're shattering the skills gap and shaping future generations of technologists. Transform your work. Transform your team. Ready to tap in? Visit us at Pluralsight.com to learn more.
There's a certain innocence or naivete to the clown, I think, that allows us as audiences to discover our world a little bit anew or have a new perspective on the world. And I think that's what's so valuable about looking at gender through the lens of clowning is because, as you say, it's really easy to exist in the world and just not necessarily see the way that gender is being taken on or performed. But as a clown, you're like, I don't know what's going on. So I'm going to try to figure out this structure that everyone seems to somehow be participating in. And I'm going to try to figure out if it's right for me.
Welcome to Settling is Bullshit, a sweary podcast about claiming your joy. If you are an adult human craving healthier boundaries, a greater sense of purpose, or an increased capacity to feel at ease in your own skin, then you are in the right place, my friend. I'm your host, Kate Blauk, and I'm here to offer you practical tools and playful encouragement to help you step forward and be your most awesome self. My hope is that each episode will leave you feeling a bit more empowered to make brave choices and claim your joy. Hello, my friend. Today's guest is Anya Upstill, theater artist, educator, and clown, whose performances celebrate LGBTQIA+ artists with a focus on gender diversity. Anya has performed all over the world, New Zealand, Edinburgh, New York City, Washington, D.C., and many other places in between. Anya is based in New York City and in summer of 2024 had the opportunity to perform their one-person show, Transhumance, at the Kennedy Center in Washington, D.C., and thankfully, that performance was recorded and is available on YouTube, which is how I ended up inviting them to come talk to us about that performance and their unique clown's perspective on gender, gender identity, trans identity, what it is to have a gender in this crazy 21st century that we live in. So this is just such a fun, interesting conversation that applies to each and every one of us, because we all have some relationship to or experience with gender, whether we are particularly aware of it or not. And while this may have come up previously on the podcast, I identify as a woman and use she, her pronouns. I am also cisgender, which is a term that you're going to hear us using on this podcast. And if you're not familiar, it means that my internal sense of gender corresponds with the sex that I was assigned at birth. So I was assigned female at birth and I identify as a woman. That makes me cisgender. Anya is going to talk to us about some of the other terminology that comes up in conversations about gender, but we didn't specifically define that one, so I wanted to throw it up here at the front. And this is an episode that is about gender, but it's also about clowning and how that particular perspective or framework can be a really fun and interesting and playful and mentally healthful perspective to take on the world. So whether issues of gender and gender equity are particularly up for you or not, this episode is a really delightful experience, and I am happy to get to share it with you. I also just want to throw out there that I am still giving away free stickers if you leave a review after you listen to this episode. Take a picture of your rating or review wherever you're listening to this podcast. Email it to me at kate@settlingisbullshit.com, and I will send you stickers in the mail. And I'm going to run this until I run out of stickers, which will be a little while. So leave a rating or review and enjoy this episode. So do you identify as trans?
I do. I identify as trans. Sometimes I also add non-binary. I have a lot of feelings about how people generally associate people being transgender with medical transitioning. And I personally prefer to think of it through the lens of like the Latin root trans, which means through, across, or beyond. And that feels much more appropriate to my personal feeling about gender. So I like using transgender. And I think some people assume that there's a medical transition component when people use that term.
Right.
So also I'm like, non-binary is also correct. And maybe I also just like resisting categories, which is kind of the whole point.
Yeah. I mean, right. That makes sense. Yeah. I'd love to hear a little bit more about that sort of like Latin root trans, across and beyond, and kind of what that means to you in finding your gender journey, you know, where you have found yourself.
Yeah. I think I was very lucky to be raised in Berkeley, which it does give a different perspective to gender than many other places in the country, I think especially in the sort of 90s and 2000s. And I was also very lucky to be raised by parents who were and still are very gender nonconforming themselves. So I don't think I felt particularly restricted by gender. And it took me moving outside of Berkeley to realize that I maybe also didn't fit into gendered stereotypes around women totally. And even though I did go through a period of kind of hyper femininity, which I think was me being like, what is gender? Wow, gender's so weird. Like,
yeah, what did that look like?
I mean, I used to like sew my own dresses in high school. I did like rock and roll dancing. Like I went really like 50s, which
okay.
And now with more historical knowledge, I'm like, terrible time to be a woman. Like actually, wow, we're really in a much better place right now. But the romance of it, I think, and the red lipstick and all of that. Then actually when I was in physical theater school and embodying a lot more things and recognizing, I think, how strict expectations are on gender. And also like within the sort of commedia dell'arte, especially like the physical theater tradition can be very specific about how you perform gender.
Yeah.
I just went like, no, like this is not me. I this is classic. I watched a YouTube video about being non-binary and I was like, oh my God, that's me. And then I just never went back.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And yeah, just listening to you, I mean, I'm so excited to talk about clowning and your background and training in that, because you are the clown in my life. You're the clown that I know. I don't think that most people are like, oh yeah, I know somebody who is a professional clown. But I have done improv comedy a lot. I love it. It brings me so much joy. And it's really funny because my kind of go-to character when I'm doing improv is like dude bros. I just love leaning into like, yeah, bro, like, what up? Like, huh. And that just like really performative hypermasculinity is really fun for me to play with. I think because it is so different from sort of my normal day-to-day reality, but also like I was a tomboy as a kid. You know, I really didn't identify with femininity until adulthood for me when I was like, oh no, I actually do like being a girl. This is interesting and nice for me.
No, I love that because I think one of the things that I think is very true for some people is that your gender identity changes over time.
Yeah.
Your gender identity, your gender expression. And I think that's maybe under-discussed in terms of cis people. It's like you can be a cisgender person and have your gender expression change super drastically. And that's also you finding like the joy in your gender.
Right.
I think that gender euphoria feels more, sometimes feels like a bigger win for transgender or gender expansive people, but like everyone has it and I want everyone to have it.
Oh my God, I love that. Like I invited you on this podcast and it hadn't occurred to me that this could also apply to me as a cisgender person, right? But just in this moment, I'm like, yeah, like you could not, like my mom despaired because she could not get me in a dress. She could not get me in pink. I was having none of it in my youth. Like I just wanted to climb trees and dresses were girly and stupid and I hated them. And then it's been really in adulthood for me of like finding a deeper connection with my femininity and being like, actually, I fucking love pink. Pink makes me so happy. So I don't know. I'm just having this really heartwarming moment of like, oh, I get to have that too.
100%. And actually, ironically, I think my kind of iconoclastic mother probably hated the fact that actually as a small child, me and my twin sister decided we loved pink and purple respectively and were like all into the dresses. I feel like she was like, really? You never see me wearing makeup and you're into this? But, you know, she honored it. She was fighting.
Yeah. And I don't know. There's a, like, to me, I just hear in that level of adolescent, like, I'm going to try not being like you and see what happens. Right.
Oh, yes. The classic. Real classic. Yeah.
Yeah. So what does gender euphoria mean to you that you want for everyone?
I think it's both feeling, you know, in alignment between how you feel inside and your expression. Mm-hmm. So getting to express, and that's mostly aesthetically, you know, gender expression is mostly aesthetic, but like getting to express through clothing, makeup, hair, gesture, affectation, whatever, the gender that you want to express. And I'm not saying that people's gender identity and gender expression always have to look the way we want them to look, right? Like you can you can be like, I'm non-binary and I dress super femme and that's what makes me happy. That's your gender for you. Like, fuck yeah. And I think that I want people to have the expression that makes them happy and gives them joy as they move through the world. And I truly do want that for everyone, because I also think that diversity is such a beautiful thing. And like, I want to see everyone feeling themselves all the time. The ideal world.
Yes. Oh my God, me too. Of just like, what if we all moved through the world like feeling ourselves?
Yeah.
In whatever way that looks.
Yeah. And maybe your gender expression is like, I want to wear sweatpants all the time. Like, fuck yeah. Whatever makes you feel good, I am here for it. I have no interest in judging anyone else's choices.
Yeah. And I got to watch the recording of Transhumance. Mm-hmm. And what struck me was the way that like we try on gender, right? The mm-hmm. character in that show puts on a dress, puts on a kind of tie. And watching it, I was just thinking about like how often we put on these outfits, put on these roles without thinking about it or asking like, does this really fit me? Is this really what I want? And so for those of y'all who are listening and haven't seen it yet, I'm going to put the link in the show notes. You can watch it. It's delightful, but it is a 1-hour show without any dialogue.
That is true. Yes,
it is. Which is amazing. And when I describe it that way, your mind might be like, what are you talking about? But it's so good. It's so expressive. It turns out that with clowning and commedia dell'arte, is that what we would call what that is?
Well, I would say the show is clowning. Clowning comes out of commedia dell'arte. Commedia dell'arte is probably a little more like improv in that it relies on character.
Okay.
And weirdly, you know, I feel like I made that show and that clown is not really a character. That clown is kind of just a part of me, which is not how everyone makes clowning.
What is clowning? How do we even define what we're talking about when we're talking about clowning?
Great. People define it in a lot of ways. So I want to say there's a lot of different kind of aesthetics or sort of approaches to clowning. The clowning I see coming out of LA feels very stand-up comedy influenced. It's a lot of talking. Oh. The clowning I was trained in comes from the Lecoq School in France. So I think of it as like European style clowning, which tends to be about physical theater. It comes out of this commedia dell'arte tradition, which kind of was transitioned over time. And so it has a long history. And then, of course, there's circus clowning. And circus clowning tends to be more trick-based or routine-based. And
pratfalls,
juggling, there's more skills. So when I sometimes talk about like the hard skills of clowning, which are kind of what I think about with like ringling and like literally what they would teach people at ringling school.
Yeah.
And then the sort of soft skills, which I think are more about clown perspective, the way the clown interacts with the world. And I think why that is so valuable is there's a certain innocence or naivete to the clown, I think, that allows us as audiences to discover our world a little bit anew or have a new perspective on the world. And I think that's what's so valuable about looking at gender through the lens of clowning, is because as you say, it's really easy to exist in the world and just not necessarily see the way that gender is being taken on or performed. But as a clown, you're like, I don't know what's going on, so I'm going to try to figure out this structure that everyone seems to somehow be participating in, and I'm going to try to figure out if it's right for me. Right? That's kind of the premise of the show. It's like,
yeah. And it's like so beautiful. I mean, that's exactly what I experienced in watching it, of like, oh, like what would happen if someone who didn't know anything about gender just sort of like showed up in this world and was like, oh, what am I supposed to do? Right. And it was just so beautiful. Is so beautiful. It exists. There's an archive now.
Yes. And I will say it's not just resonant with trans people.
Yeah.
We had cisgender people like bawl during the show and then kind of come up and be like, oh my gosh, that was so real. Because I do think, especially if you are a person who has experienced like oppression or marginalization for your gender. So like, basically, I mean, women and anyone who's not a cis man, but you know, any kind of marginalized gender. Yeah, I think you can feel that. And if you're a cis man, like, gender is also really oppressive there too. I think these structures are not set up to respect the reality of people's lives.
Yeah. And I feel like I saw that, right, when the character is trying on sort of like what masculinity is supposed to look like and whatnot. It really touched me of like, yeah, we're all just having these boxes forced upon us in contemporary capitalist patriarchal society. And like, it's not great for anybody. Like,
yeah, it's not. It's really not.
Yeah. What was the kind of trans or non-binary queer folk reaction? How was it received?
I think people feel very deeply seen. The anecdote that sticks with me is there was a young person who came and saw it when I did the show in Adelaide in 2020, right before the world shut down. Anyway, and sent me a message later on Facebook. It was like, thank you for the show. I'm now in the middle of my transition. And like, your show meant so much to me. And I just wanted to let you know that it had this impact. And, you know, if you're ever in Adelaide, like, I would love to see anything you make. So it was that sort of thing. And then I think I was also very struck by parents coming to the show. When it was in Edinburgh, there was a couple who came up afterwards and were like, hey, we're actually pregnant and we want to raise our child in a different way. So like, thank you for this show. And, you know, it's that kind of thing where I'm like, that is the impact I want to have. Because again, it's super easy to grow up and just follow these very strict binary rules. And I just don't think it really serves people.
No. And what I hear in that is just like, without the supportive container, it's really hard to break out of, right? Or to find our way, or to find what's like true for us.
Yeah. I mean, that's the core of, I think, why queer joy specifically and representation as a related factor are really important. You know, representation is like, it's like, if I hadn't seen that YouTube video about being non-binary, like maybe it would have taken me another couple of years. You know, there's a lot more exposure now for trans and non-binary people, which is really great. And I think about how important also seeing queer people being happy is, because there's so many stories about trauma.
Yeah.
And it's gonna be like, look, it's really not that bad. It's actually kind of great.
Yeah. What do you love about sort of your life now and who you have found yourself to be?
You know, I do get to be exactly who I want to be. I feel like I'm in a position where I do get to live my own gender euphoria consistently. Uh-huh. And I have a community that is supportive of that. And maybe almost more importantly, because I'm an educator, I get to be that person around other people very overtly. Mm-hmm. And because I work as a teaching artist, I often go into situations where I am not necessarily teaching about gender, but I think just by being myself and using they, them pronouns, which not all young people in the New York City school system understand, it's just like opening a door or an opportunity for students to see that maybe a different type of gender expression or gender identity is open for them.
So, I mean, what, like, how do you explain your gender expression to them? Do you get questions about it? Do you explain it?
I don't get a lot of questions, but I do try to be very overt about being open to questions and then also modeling using more like gender expansive language rather than just men and women.
Yeah. So people,
you know, if we're talking about abortion, talking about how it affects people who have uteruses, because it doesn't just affect women, those sorts of things where like they're kind of subtle linguistic shifts, but I think they're important. And, you know, as my students get more comfortable with me, they're more likely to be like, what does that mean? Or like, why are you using that? And I think that's also a really good learning point.
So what are some of the kind of big misconceptions you encounter or the things that you're like, oh, I sort of assumed you might be literate about that, but apparently not. For like anybody who's listening who doesn't feel super literate about this, here are the things we should be paying attention to.
Sure. Well, you know, I'm going to frame this within the gender diversity training that I co-run with a friend of mine, because we were in the same master's program together. And at some point, we both just realized, as the two students who used they, them pronouns, that we were getting a lot of questions, but they weren't happening in a sort of formal way. It was like other students at various times asking questions. And we were like, look, y'all, we're just going to do this in a training. We're going to answer all your questions in one go. And then you'll like at least have some information. So I think people don't really understand the separation of sex and gender as a baseline. Mm-hmm. And I think people get, and this is a very human trait, people get really worried about doing the wrong thing.
Yeah.
So they don't ask the question. And so, well, I think people don't understand that transgender can be a more broad category than people who are medically transitioning from woman to man or man to woman. Like that the goal is not necessarily to pass. You know, there's a lot of kind of stuff in there. I also think people get a little confused with like, oh, you can be cisgender but gender nonconforming, or you can be cisgender and also androgynous. That there's, you know, there's a lot of nuance in how people find their identity and their expression intermeshing or not.
Mm-hmm.
And really, the thing we say, Rachel and I, when we're teaching is like, you actually don't have to understand it to respect it. So baseline, if someone's wearing something and you're like, but why are they wearing that if their pronouns are this other thing? No. Just use their pronouns. Yeah. You actually don't need to like ask the question, cognitively like figure it out for yourself. Like all you need to do is just like use their name and pronouns and just like go about your day.
I feel some freedom in that. Like, that's nice, right? Of just, what if we just like accepted what people tell us about themselves?
Like, yeah, it would be great.
Jesus. Yeah, and I feel that element of gender euphoria. Oh yeah, I guess there's a question of like, do you feel like gender is really the relationship between gender and pronouns is pretty intertwined?
I think it's one of the ways that people express their gender.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a one-to-one, you know, especially because there's people who use like multiple pronouns or one pronoun for different reasons.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for some people, it might be like, well, I actually just kind of feel fluid, so I use all of them. Or there might be someone who's like, I'll accept all of them, but I have a preference for this one because it's how I want people to refer to me, but I don't want to feel misgendered, so I'm going to use multiple pronouns.
Yeah.
So it's definitely not a one-to-one. I think it's just one of the most obvious ways that people flag their gender sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah. What was your process of choosing they, them?
Well, so when I finished physical theater school, I'd already been like, I'm non-binary. And then I was like, well, I'm moving to New York and I'm meeting all these new people, so I'm going to change my pronouns because I feel like they, them is right for me.
Yeah.
Which was a lot easier than doing it in a place where I'd already lived. I mean, I've had to do that when I've gone back to places that I've lived or before I moved. But it was really nice to get to just like start using they, them pronouns and have everyone just use them. I mean, not everyone, yeah. like, right. like most, but people that I met who were like good at using pronouns.
Right. Right. Yeah. I mean, I think like Portland is also kind of a bubble in terms of people are real good about pronouns around here for the most part. And then I go other places and I'm like, oh, yeah, there's a lot of the world that this is not a thing yet. And it's confusing and it's hard. And I just want to offer some empathy to cisgender folks who are trying, you know, and it is confusing. And
yeah, I mean, I misgender people. I want to be really clear that like everyone does it because yeah. humans aren't perfect and we're actually not that good at learning new information.
Right.
So 100%, I would love to extend grace to people. I really hope that on both sides of the equation, we can understand that it's like the trying that really matters.
Yeah.
And the apology if you don't do it right, but then just moving on. Because truly, yeah. what's really funny is when some, not funny, what's really like unnecessary is when someone messes up and then is like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I can't believe. And then it's like, just say I'm sorry, correct it, and move on.
This is yeah. Yeah, right? That like this is all learning and unlearning, right? I mean, I think learning to use they, them pronouns is also an unlearning of the sort of binary gender structures that we, the majority of us grew up, all of us like millennials and older grew up with.
Yeah. Right? And I think even Gen Z,
yeah,
most of them would have had family systems that, you know, or been in nuclear families that used binary. So I'm like, we're
yeah. Oh yeah, but I don't know. Those are the youths. I'm not going to speak for them. I have no idea. They all seem much more woke than our generation. I don't know.
You know what's so interesting is I think they are, but I do think it's like even within the New York City school system, I can see that it's school by school.
Yeah.
I'm like, this is wild. Culture matters so much.
It does. It matters so much. You know, like I just said, right? Like Portland is a really gender aware, trans inclusive city on the whole. And that also probably depends on like what part of town you're in. But I think one of the things I have learned having moved around a fair bit and trying to find my place is how important the places that we live and the spaces that we kind of inhabit can be in allowing us to be who we are.
Yeah, it's massive. And again, like, I don't know if I hadn't grown up in Berkeley, honestly, my trauma as a queer and trans person would probably be a lot higher.
Yeah. Yeah. Growing up in Las Vegas did a number on me as a like as at the time, like a gender nonconforming female. Right. I wasn't doing the kind of like makeup and the dressing and the whatever. And it was bad. And it wasn't really until I left and like moved to Austin, Texas, that I actually felt permission to explore my femininity in a space that felt like there was a much more expansive vision of that. Cause like in Vegas, it's fucking, you know, fake tits and like spray tan and just that in a lot of ways version of femininity. If I have any Vegas listeners, I love you. You understand what I'm talking about. It is a hard place to grow up as a girl. And so for me, there was a lot of like moving away from that and into cowboy boots and sundresses and being like, oh, this is fun. I like this, you know?
Yeah. Cowboy boots are like, I mean, they're just great.
They're so good. I don't get to wear them very often in Portland because it rains too much, but I do still have my collection. Okay, I have taken a somewhat far afield. Back to clowning. And that as an art form that you were drawn to, that you champion, that you use, what lights you up about clowning?
Oh, it's definitely the sense of curiosity and expansiveness and how that creates joy. It's really funny. When I was a baby, so going way back, my dad used to call me the joy baby because I was so like, I guess just I would smile. I was like really happy. I was a really happy child. And then I feel like, you know, whatever, the world happened and we all, you know, lose some of that childhood joy, I think, over time, you know. Also, we get used to things, we get numb to things. But clowning really allows you to access that wonder and that curiosity in a very special way that I think kind of has a special potency in our world that is so, I don't know, full of information, and in which, in some ways, I think there's a real pressure to know the right thing or say the right thing or, you know, do the right thing. There's a real, a permission to play and to learn. Mm. And I think those are just things that are really good for our brains. Like, I've taught clowning for mental health before because I think that the practice of like being in a state of exploration is just cognitively good for people.
Yeah.
About that as well. It's not just me.
Right. Yeah. So I guess I'm curious, like, what's the distinction for you between like improv and clowning?
Improv, which I have an okay relationship with, but I've never personally been.
Oh, okay. I love it. That's what I have experience with. And it brings, like, it brings me so much joy because it's just like this process of like, I don't know what's going to happen next. Like, mm-hmm. Let's just discover it together and play and like be comfortable fucking up because there's no right way to do it. And that was like so freeing for me as someone who used to be like really uptight and want to do it right and really had the anxiety of, but like, no, I got to get it right. It was terrifying and freeing for me to be in that space of play and curiosity and exploration. So listening to you talk about clowning, I'm like, these sound similar. So I'd love to like understand like what makes clowning.
Yeah, no, I think so. It's that's funny is like what you're saying about improv is very resonant of how I feel about clowning. And similarly, when I started clowning, I actually thought I was going to hate clowning. I went to a physical theater school that is not just about clowning. And clowning was the thing I was like, I'm going to hate this. So
Okay. To pause. So what's the distinction between physical theater and clowning?
I would say clowning is a form of physical theater. Okay. So yeah, physical theater is more like the basket. And clowning is like a ball, a juggling ball in the basket, just to keep it.
Yeah. And like we actually met through a Shakespearean performance program, and then you went off and had a beautiful big life, and it's exciting to catch up with you again. What drew you to a physical performance school?
Well, so I did. So having done a lot of Shakespeare, which is obviously very text based.
Yeah.
And I did do Shakespeare for a while. And then I kind of went, well, the things I really love about the, you know, original practice approach to Shakespeare, which is, you know, as you know, is what we did at Wynedale, talking to the audience and performing with the lights on and those sort of fun things, was that it was more heightened and more physical and had a sort of direct relationship to the audience in terms of storytelling. And I realized that it took me a long time, I think, to realize that I'm actually a very physical person. Like I probably had a type A perfection. No, I definitely had a type A like perfectionist blocked, being like, well, if I can't be the best, I'm not going to do it. So I gave up on sports pretty early because I wasn't that good.
Oh, yes. And for me, it was team pressure. Like it was that. And it was also team pressure of like, I don't want my not being good enough to bring everybody down. So like, I can't handle this. I'm not going to play.
Mm. Yeah. Well, I couldn't be the best at it. So I stopped. Which is like, honestly, I'm like, really? Now I'm like, wow, you really should have just stuck with sports. Sports are great. Anyway, yeah, we have the journeys we have. So anyway, I think I wanted to explore this more physical side of performance. I'd taken a couple of workshops in New Zealand. And so I went, the school is outside of Arcata in Northern California. So it's actually pretty close to where you are.
Okay.
And they sort of, the structure of the program is in the fall, you do 10 weeks of physical theater training. And then in the spring, you do three forms of physical theater. So we did commedia dell'arte and melodrama and clown. And I was like, I'm going to hate clown, but I'm just going to have to get through it. Whatever. I'm not funny.
Mm.
And I did hate it at first. And I think being in the physical theater program really broke me of some of these ideas about having to be perfect or the best or that sort of genre of ways to be hard on yourself. And so by the time I got to clowning, I think I was in a better place to accept it. And I also discovered that I could still be a character that connected with the audience without having to be like kind of traditionally funny all the time. Because I don't think my clown is very, in general, my clowning is not necessarily like laugh out loud funny. It's not Ringling Clown. It's not, you know, these like big setups. It's actually like my clown is a very connected to the audience, storytelling, narrative-based clowning.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I really loved it. I also 100%, like, I personally believe that everyone has multiple clowns inside of them, which probably come from different aspects of their personalities. And the clown that I found at Del Arte was like, she was such a bitch. Like, it was really fun. She was like the most high status clown in the class. And she just like didn't like anything. And I think I was just really like exercising that like perfectionist side of myself, being like, no, like, I'm not going to enjoy anything. I'm just going to stand over here and tell people what to do. So it was kind of a gift in those ways. And then I kind of just kept doing it because I found it easy to make short form work. And I moved to New York and I was doing nightlife performance. So it wasn't actually super intentional, but it just ended up being this form that I really resonated with. And the more I do it and the more I teach it, the more I'm like, wow, this is like a practice for life. Like, this is like a mental health practice. It's a like a cognitive practice, and it's a skill. So
what are some of the ways in which that shows up as a like mental health practice? Like, what are some of the elements that you bring forth?
You know, it's mostly presence. I feel like it's a little bit like a moving meditation in that clowning really asks you to be like hyper present with like the minutiae of the things around you in a very childlike way. You know, it's like discovery, play, like anything can become an object of play. So it feels like, it kind of feels like a moving meditation. And I do think in a world where we're like not just probably overstimulated.
Definitely overstimulated.
Overstimulated, like too many things coming in. And then like also, you know, so many people work remotely. So many people are sort of context switching all the time. It's like we're kind of having almost, I think, an out-of-body experience.
Yeah.
It's also a very like embodied form and a form where you are like asked to like physically touch things and be very present in your actual physical space.
Yeah. So, okay. So if I were to do a like clowning practice, what would you tell me to do right now to do what you just talked about?
I would tell you to get a pencil or something really easy to manipulate. And look at it.
Okay.
And in your mind, just go like, wow. Like, give it a little like, wow.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I literally have a pencil in my hand right now, and I'm looking at the little like metal bit that like attaches it to the wooden part and to the eraser. And like, I've never looked at that. Not really. I'm like, wow.
Yeah. And then, you know, you could take it farther. You could go, well, what, you know, you're a clown. You don't know what a pencil is. What can this pencil do? You know, like, what could it be? You know, how could it move in space? You know, it's like, that I think is to me is the basis of like clown perspective. It's just being like, it's like truly like encapsulated by the word wow.
Yeah, like wow. And I don't know. And like, what, is, like when you just ask, like, what is this thing in front of me? What could I do with it? And of course, because like there's an inner 5-year-old in me, like I want to stick it up my nose, right? Like that was like, as soon as you asked that question, I was like, oh, well, like an eraser would go up my nose. Like that's what pencils are for, right? Like
that's what pencils are for. Yeah.
Yeah.
100%.
Yeah. Ugh, I love that. I love that. So, okay, that was delightful. Now I'm going to do that after our call. What does that do for mental health?
Yeah, so I think a lot of it is getting a break. I think it's the same. I think a lot of it's the same as meditation. It's like getting to be present, breaking whatever mental habits you're in. You know, as someone who has anxiety, I find it really grounding,
mm-hmm.
you know, because you're like kind of giving yourself a little like interruption of whatever worries are going on in your brain. And also just makes you smile. It's kind of like laughter yoga. I feel like often clowning, you're just like having a nice time. And I think that's also really important. Yeah. And, you know, I do think that's why there's been a big surge in clowning, at least in New York. And I think in LA as well, a lot of interest in teaching. There's like a New York City clown WhatsApp group that I think has like 400 members. Like it's, which,
yeah,
for what is considered a niche discipline is a lot of humans.
Right.
I think also people just want to laugh right now because there's so much happening in the world that is like maybe not great.
Just, yeah. I think I'm going to just take the maybe out of that. Yeah. Like, there is so much happening in the world that is not great. There's a lot out there that's not ideal. And actually, well, and that touches on part of what I have found really interesting and attractive about the work you've done, the performances you've done. It seems like you take on kind of big topics, but in a playful, curious, potentially laugh-inducing way.
Yeah, I think, especially with Transhumance, but also with A Bit Too Much Hair, which is the musical cabaret show I co-wrote / write about gender euphoria. It's like, I think people shut down when they feel like they're being lectured. I think it's really hard to get people to even go to or participate in something if they feel like they're being lectured to, or it's going to be something that they disagree with. And I think that taking a more joyful, lighthearted approach, even though it can feel, I don't know, like compared to like a protest, it's kind of like, well, is that going to help? Like making people feel good? And I'm like, actually,
I 100%, right? I mean, and this is kind of one of the things I wrestle with this podcast and my own writing is that, like, what if we could talk about things that are hard and that are often heavy in a way that's like a little bit more lighthearted and a little bit more inviting?
Like, yeah. We live in such the political situation in this country tends to be very binary, like gender, and very polarizing. And I struggle to see how we can move towards a more understanding world if we can't have conversation. And I think that a gentler approach is more proactive than a harder edged approach. And, you know, especially with something like Transhumance, where it's like, there's not really words. You kind of just you experience the show as the clown experiences it. I think there's potential there for people to create, in applied theater, we talk about meaning making, right? You can make the meaning you need to make from that show. Not that it doesn't have a message, but that like you can access it from your own experience. It's not limited to people who are transgender or people who are gender expansive. Like we all experience gender.
Yeah. Right. Wherever we fall on the spectrum, you know, it's a reality that we operate within.
And I think people are more likely to accept something if they also experience how great it can be. I think it's harder to watch something about queer joy and be like, God, I really hope my child isn't queer because their life's going to be really hard, which is what my mother told me when I came out to her. She was like, but could you just date men? It'll be easier. And I was like, I could, but I don't want to. Like, I feel like maybe I want to be true to how I feel, which is that I'm not just going to date men. So, you know, I do think it's important as also a way of being like, how can we address the fear that people have around identities? And I think that there's more to be shown than just trauma, for sure.
Yeah. And like, what I hear in that, I feel like applies to all of us, that really being ourselves and honoring what is true for us and like what we want and how we want to be in the world often isn't easy, right? Like it's easy to stay in a structure and in a box that is the expectation of us. And it's hard to like acknowledge that that doesn't really fit and to make choices to step outside of it, you know?
Yeah. And I think the joy part of it is like, and also it's great.
Oh, yeah, totally.
You know, it's like, and that's yeah. what it is, because it's legitimately hard. So if we don't celebrate the parts of it that are good, it's just going to feel hard.
Right. Absolutely. Right. Like I have made a number of unconventional choices in my life that have been like hard. Like I left a tenure track job in academia where I would have gotten tenure. And like, that was a big deal to be like, this doesn't work. But it didn't work for me. Like, it just didn't. And like, oh my God, I'm so much happier being able to have a podcast that I swear on and not having to like try to persuade college freshman football players that they need to give a fuck about Shakespeare. Like, it's just not like that wasn't my journey. But like, that also wasn't an easy decision to make. Right.
Right. Your mom might have been like, but are you sure?
Oh, my mom didn't want me to be an English major. She wanted me to like fucking go into computer science or hotel management because those were more like practical, lucrative like careers when I was at University of Nevada, Las Vegas. Like,
yeah. And yep. You know, how great that you've made those choices and you get to have your joy in making those choices.
Yeah, yeah.
Or being true to yourself. And then like, I don't know. It's interesting, the idea of choice, right? Like, that's a whole conversation.
Well, yeah. And like, to be clear, it is sexual orientation, not sexual preference, everybody. Like, right? So that's a slightly, I pivoted it a little bit. But like, careers are choices. Like, those are choices.
Yeah.
Yeah, college majors, those are choices.
But I do think the sort of resonant point for me is the like, yes, it is, can be challenging to live in a way that is not accepted by your family, maybe your culture, you know, in various ways. And it can be really beautiful to be able to live in a way that is true to yourself, whether that's your identity or your, you know, best occupation or whatever it is. And I do think, I mean, I think that's like what you celebrated your podcast. And I think it's what's really important to celebrate.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, and the other things that are coming up for me of like having kids, not having kids, right? There's joy in both of those things. And I super respect everybody's choice in that matter of like, bless all of you parents. You are superheroes. That's not the choice I have made for myself.
Yeah. And I think where we get hung up as humans actually is assuming that the choice that we make for ourselves is the right choice for everyone.
Yeah.
And that's sort of where the you don't have to understand it to respect it comes in, is it's like, this does not have to be true for you to go love that you're living that life, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, like, I love that for you, but in a, like, sincere way.
Yeah. And I think it's partly that we get, you know, I mean, we're tribal creatures, and we, like, love an in-group. We fucking love being with people that we're like. And also, I think people get a little scared of, like, well, is this right for me? Like, if something challenges the status quo, then what does it bring up for themselves? I'm like, if it brings something up, it brings something up. But, you know, everyone still gets to live their best life.
Yeah. And I think that for me, that's where the like sort of self-awareness piece comes in, of like when I'm uncomfortable about something, like it's often because I feel threatened in some capacity, whether it's my sweet little ego, you know, comparing myself to other people, whatever, like internal systems of judgment, right? And just recognizing that like most of that shit is just in my head, that when I'm feeling like, oh, that person's doing a thing, and does that mean I should be doing that? You know, that person isn't thinking about me.
Right.
I don't care.
Yeah. I like to remind myself that we think about ourselves way more than anyone else thinks about us by like a huge margin.
Right. Like,
really big margin.
Yeah. Totally. And yeah, I think about that, especially with transphobia, with homophobia, right? It's the sort of like way in which like how other people are living becomes a threat to a different person's existence. I'm not going to put myself in that one. Right. And that, I don't know, just the world I'm working towards is like, what if we just let everybody be who they are?
Yeah. I say this to my students. I'm like, I truly don't understand why people care. Like, I truly don't. I'm like, it doesn't impact your life who someone else marries or who they're sleeping with. Like, I don't understand.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and I know when I quit drinking, to sort of pivot that train of thought just a little bit, is that oftentimes what can happen, and then this happens for other folks in recovery, is that like when we quit drinking, the people that we're around can find that threatening because they feel like they need to look at their drinking or behavior or whatever. And yeah, I'm just struck by the ways in which we so often just internalize how like what other people are doing is somehow a metric of what we should be doing. But that's like pervasive, right? I mean, that is what culture is. Like existing in a culture is having these sort of like societal expectations. But I think I'm feeling hopeful for the future and just like hopeful for the world that we are co-creating by having this kind of conversation, by really choosing to celebrate joy and to focus on the like joyful aspects of making counterculture choices.
Totally. And, you know, it's so much bigger than gender or sexuality, too. I think I really hope, yeah, we can move towards a place where we can, respect all of who people are without feeling attacked. Because I really think that is what it is a lot of the time. It's the fear of, if someone else is doing it, should I be doing it?
Yeah.
And or if someone else is doing it, but it's not what I'm doing, then one of us must be wrong, so it must be them.
Oh, yeah. Totally, totally, right? And I think that's like, what comes up for me around that is just like thinking about like the really broad spectrum of like femininity. And even for me, I can struggle to respect sort of choices around feminine presentation, right? Even when I was talking about like in a disparaging way, like fake boobs just a few minutes ago, right? Like there's a way in which I'm like, oh, that's wrong. And I don't even always notice that I'm doing it.
Yeah. And I think where that gets complicated for me is on the one hand going, whatever you want to do with your body, fine. I do feel very strongly that people who feel fine about plastic surgery should feel fine about physical transition for trans people because they're the thing. And that's not a conversation that happens enough. Right. And I think it is interesting to engage with why we as a, well, what we're saying culturally about what a woman should look like.
Right.
And how that pressures people into doing things that otherwise they might not choose to do. And I think like Botox is a really good example because like there's such a prevalence of it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was talking to a friend in tech and she was like, well, you know, people do it because you get paid more in tech if you look younger as a woman. And I was like, so there's a couple things happening. Like, there's the pressure to get Botox because the tech industry is like rewarding women for getting Botox, which means they're going to feel like they have to get Botox, which then is it a choice? Right. So there's like a couple things I think we need to like look at critically.
Yeah.
While also being like, look, you can get Botox. I'm not going
right.
to. I die of bacteria in my face is terrifying to me.
Right. Yeah. So it's the sort of like question of the systems and the all of it. But I don't know. I just feel good about catching myself in that moment of like just recognizing that like, oh, yeah, like I do have judgment about people's choice. And that's human, right? Like we do that. It's super normal. And it can be really sneaky.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, in the correlation in the like transgender community is that like the, you know, there's this sort of I think there can be a pressure to medically transition.
Yeah.
And I'm a little too old to be in that world. Like I kind of came out a little too early and I'm like, oh, interesting that people are, you know, doing this. And I think it's gender affirming care saves lives.
100%.
And I would love to live in a world where we'd manage to separate gender and sex a little bit more because physical changes lives in that world of like, kind of like sex and physiology and like what we expect people to physically look like. And gender is something that I think we can be like, you will respect whatever gender you are without expecting your sex to be the same. And so it's like, yeah, it's again, there's these conversations are really interesting because we live in all these cultural norms.
Right.
Flex. And also, I do want people to just have whatever gender affirming surgery and joy in whatever way.
Right. 100%. I love that connection of like people who are okay with plastic surgery, like should be okay with gender affirming care.
Is literally the same. I mean, it's the same surgeons doing it.
Like, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. It's getting a surgical alteration to your body so that you can feel better in your body.
Yes.
Right. Well,
bless people who feel like they want to do that. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. Ugh, Anya, this has been such a delight. Just like sprawling, rambling, wonderful conversation. I really love to ask people as we wind down, what brings you joy?
You know, sharing food with people that I love brings me a lot of joy.
Mm.
And conversations about art, making art with people is probably my favorite thing. Specifically, making theater with people is probably my favorite thing. And, you know, actually teaching. I had a moment last spring where I went, the most radical thing I can do for my students is just to be like hyper present with them. To get back to clowning, just to really actually listen, because attention is such a, it's being taken away from us, I think, in a lot of ways in life. And I think attention is really radical. So it brings me a lot of joy to give people deep attention.
I love that. I'm going to adopt that as well. I mean, I think that's one of the things that, again, to bring it a little, it's similar to improv. Like improv is about just like really being present and really listening, because you don't know what the fuck is going to happen next and you can't plan ahead. Right. And that has definitely heightened my skill set in being present and available and connected and setting fucking devices aside. And, you know,
look, you're selling me on improv, and I have not ever been sold on improv. So great work.
Well, you're selling me on clowning. So I'm like, okay, is there anywhere in Portland that like we can do some?
Is. Clowns Without Borders is based in Portland. There's clowns around.
Oh, amazing. Well, look at that. I just found a new little adventure for me to explore. Beautiful. Anya, where can people find you?
Probably most easily on my website. And also, I don't really do social media very much because I hate it. But I do.
Fair.
I have Instagram as Butch Mermaid, which is also my company name. So, I mean, good luck. But I was never posted.
But like every once in a while when you're doing a thing, like, right, we can follow your account. And then, you know, when you have a thing coming up, we'll know about it. That's how I learned about Transhumance. And it was great. So thank you so much. This has been a joy.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please help me grow the podcast by subscribing, leaving a review, and sharing it with anyone you think would benefit from hearing it too. Your support means the world to me. If you'd like to get updates about new episodes, posts, and offerings, please visit settlingisbullshit.com to subscribe to my newsletter. You can also find information there about working with me one-on-one to build your most amazing life. Until next time, remember that I believe in you, and that you are fucking awesome.